This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. In this episode, we talk about designing aircraft liveries, and our main man Micah helps celebrate the 400th episode of the Plane Talking UK Podcast. It's coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 694 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Since I'll be out of pocket for several weeks, we've pre-recorded some guest interviews for upcoming episodes. We'll also stir in some other pre-recorded segments from our contributors. For this episode, I got together with co-hosts Max Trescott, Rob Mark, and Brian Coleman. Max Trescott, of course, is host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's a national CFI of the year, and he's an expert on the Cirrus aircraft. Rob Mark is a contributing editor to Business and Commercial Aviation, part of the Aviation Week group, and publisher at Jetwine.com. Brian Coleman is our former associate producer and co-host, now field contributor, or something like that. We haven't figured out what his title is yet. But our guest this episode is Edmund Hewitt. He's the Chief Creative Officer and partner at Forward Media, as well as its design division, Forward Studio. As you'll hear, Edmund's team designed the livery for Northern Pacific Airways, and we learn about the art and science of airline liveries. So let's get right to it. We're speaking with Edmund Hewitt. He's the Chief Creative Officer and partner at Forward Media, as well as its design division, Forward Studio. Edmund had a successful career in advertising, design, and public relations with major companies as clients, but in 2016, he shifted gears to focus on aviation, sort of a childhood passion of his, and along with Peter Clark, built a practice in the airline space. So, Edmund, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thank you.
We most recently ran across your work when Brian was at the Northern Pacific Airways livery reveal, but you've had some other aviation projects, I think, along the way, and we can talk about some of those in the upcoming time here, but I wanted to ask you, as a creative designing a livery, what does that livery represent to you? We'll ask you later about the airline, but what does a livery mean to you?
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. I mean, it of course, can mean very, very many things. To our clients, the livery represents a marketing initiative, often driven by, you know, the CEO and the founders who have a personal stake. But I think from my perspective, the livery is a combination of a storytelling and the sense of sort of bringing glamour back to the sky. So, you know, I work in different capacities, and certainly when I design a livery, it's not an arbitrary decision or task. It's one there where I'm thinking through the lens of the business, the marketing goals, but at some point there is a sort of a personal connection that I'm making. And if I've done my job well, I use all of the information that I've gleaned and learned and with my research, and I mix that together with something that is highly imaginative. And out of that, hopefully comes something that translates in the best way possible. But for me, I think it's at the core of it, it has to do with storytelling. So imagining something bigger and greater than it really is, and then bringing it to life in a graphic format. So, it's at the end of the day, it's very much storytelling.
And you mentioned it's kind of personal. How do you develop that personal association with the work that you're going to do?
Well, my upbringing was one where I developed a real affinity for all things airline. So I grew up on a farm, and I didn't have a lot of distractions. I wasn't like every other kid who had, you know, Atari or 7-Eleven or MTV. So I basically had my, you know, was left to my own devices. So I used to watch movies, and I used to be a real big fan of disaster movies. So Airport, Arthur Haley, Irwin Allen's Towering Inferno. I mean, I was just really fascinated with all of that as a kid. And I used to build model airplanes, passenger planes. And I would take the plane outside and I would sort of walk around the fields. Like, you have to imagine, we lived on 20 acres of like just fields. And in the wintertime, I used to walk around with the plane and I used to hold the plane almost as if I was seeing it through the lens of a camera. And I would fly the plane, you know, in my mind, and of course physically walk around, but I would also inside the plane, I would imagine all the stories and the people talking. And because in the movie, of course, so much of it is about what's going on in the plane. And so I developed, I think, a real strong sense of storytelling and sort of, you know, the theatrics of it all. And I think all of that as a kid has sort of stayed with me. So when I'm talking about an airline project, I'm thinking through that same sort of lens of like storytelling and larger than life and an arc. And so when I design, somehow that influences me, just the romance of it all. So I really definitely credit some of my current interest and passion for sort of my early days as being someone that had to imagine and bring things to life in my mind onto paper. So I also can draw. So I would always go home after playing outside and I would draw the airplanes. So I became very good at sort of conceptualizing what an aircraft would look like inside, outside. And again, to this day, I can sketch out my thoughts and I can communicate with my team and I can say, you know, I want the tail to have sort of this sort of look. And then I would sketch it out and it would make the job easier. It would allow for my team to understand more clearly what needed to be done. And so I think all of that has really helped. And then, of course, there's just the digital design side, which is working in InDesign and working on, you know, programs that, you know, make everything more precise. But the core of it is understanding what the plane looks like from all angles. And the more intimate you get with that viewpoint, I think the better the design becomes because it respects the lines and scale and dimension of the aircraft. And so I think good liveries are ones where the person who's designing has a closer connection to the aircraft as a built form and less as just this palette where they slap, you know, a namesake on the side of the airplane.
You said from all angles. Is that because people are going to be viewing the airplane from all angles? And so somehow you need to make sure that it looks good from all directions?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, when I do the designs, a lot of the initial work is done on a very simple line art, one-dimensional flat, like profile of the aircraft. But then at some point soon within that process, you are wanting to turn that one-dimensional plane into a CAD. So that the designer can rotate the plane and then I can sort of understand how that design is going to work because people will see the plane low as a hero shot. They will see the plane above from a lounge looking down. They will see the plane far off on the tarmac. So to your point, Max, definitely there's lots of different perspectives people take on that aircraft. And so in my opinion, there's about 5 beauty shots, like really gorgeous sort of angles. And so I go to those always. On every project, whether it's looking at the plane from the rear or from the front. But it's important to understand those perspectives as much as it is to understand the flat design.
Do you put anything or is the bottom of the aircraft part of the palette?
Yep. The entire aircraft is under consideration. However, what you learn very quickly is that there are limitations based on regulatory restrictions, safety, and certain aircraft types won't or don't allow certain areas to be painted. So you have to work within those constraints. But the underbelly of the aircraft, I think, is a great opportunity for marketing. And you've seen that with other airlines, Air Canada.
Emirates certainly comes.
Emirates, yeah, Southwest. They, you know, it's as cheeky as it is effective. For someone to look up and have the namesake of the aircraft clearly seen. So I definitely wanted to, you know, add that into the mix for this project.
So at the initial stages of this, including the relationship with the airline itself, how much of the concept is developing, again, at the early stages, how much of that concept is developing from you and how much of it is, I'll use the word, specified by right. the airline?
It depends on the project, on the client. Northern Pacific Airways, probably an exception, which is they gave me pretty much a blank slate. So Rob McKinney, the CEO, who I've worked with in the past on previous, when he worked at Mokulele in Hawaii, our firm would buy media for that company. Never met him, actually. I mean, I spoke to him on the phone, but it's when he left Hawaii and moved to Alaska to work at Raven Air, which was, and still is, the local carrier that services points within the state. And so I was assuming we were going to do more media work for him. And then he said to us early on, guys, I have this special project. I'm not sure if you're interested. And then he, of course, explains that they're going to start this airline. And it was very much something that he gave me a lot of latitude on. So it was for me to sort of help lead them down a path in terms of understanding, well, who are we speaking to? What markets are we serving? Who's our competitive benchmarks? So our firm really led that journey. And that's sort of where, you know, the livery doesn't just, again, get worked on sort of in a bubble. It's sort of, we get to that point where we've done a lot of research in terms of understanding motifs, themes, sensitivity and sensibility. So Asian market, the Alaskan community, we need to really understand what matters to those people. We need to understand graphic elements and sort of where they're going to come from. So as you probably can imagine, Northern Pacific Airways, the look is very much inspired by the mountains and the pristine sort of snowy vista that is Alaska. So those are really where the colors are coming from. But a lot of work goes on behind the scenes to sort of create that mood, that story. And then once we approve that, once the client's like, yeah, I think that strategically is quite sound, then we apply it onto many touch points. Of course, the livery is the most dynamic. It's the one that most people associate with the airline, but there's many others. There's the website, there's environmental branding. So there's a whole slew, but the livery is the showpiece. So that's kind of what people assume.
And Edmund, that was actually going to be my question to you, because this is a new airline. The entire corporate branding needs to be created. Unlike, let's say, with United, where they were known for the United Tulip and they had their color scheme and they had their font and all of that. All of this with the new airline needed to be created. Were you involved with the corporate branding in Yes. general, in addition to the livery, and have the tie-in between all of them?
Yes, absolutely. So, that's an exception, because in most cases, there's an existing standard or look and feel. And sometimes the clients want to update, modernize. Perhaps the company's been purchased and there's a merger happening. But in this case, it was really a clean slate. So part of the job was to come up with the corporate brand, but always knowing that it was going to live and breathe on an airplane and be seen as a livery. So there was this sense that what I was developing in terms of typeface, logo, standards, had to sort of work from the perspective of a livery. So, and interestingly enough, when I developed the standards guide, the first standards guide that I developed was not really one for a livery. It was really one so that they could print a business card and they had the proper Pantone colors. But somehow that document found its way over to the facility that was doing the paint job. And I didn't know this. And I intervened, luckily. And it was like, I spoke to the people there and I'm like, guys, like, that's not the right document. And they were like, thank God someone called, because we don't work in Pantone. And they were going to make their own decisions. They were about to pick like colors that they thought might match. And I stopped all that and we got involved and it worked. But I was like, oh Lord. But yeah, the standards guide created for the logo was a different task, different assignment as the livery and all of the ancillary design requirements for that.
I was wondering about that issue of creative differences, I guess, and I can envision an airline well-intended and or their marketing department or something having some ideas and maybe held strongly, but then you might look at them and say, that's not at all what we want to do. Do you carry enough weight in the process to overcome those kinds of issues?
Well, I mean, again, I think with Northern Pacific, luckily I had the support of the CEO, which helps, but that only gets you so far. To your point, there were many decision makers and stakeholders within the Northern Pacific group. And so I have learned how to put forth the most compelling solution, considering it's a subjective discussion. That's the problem, is that, you know, if you're not careful, you get into, a debate over is blue better or is pink better. Like, everybody has an opinion on color, and that makes it difficult. So what I try to do is I benchmark. I really take care with the learning. I set up the criteria in advance early on so that I'm not just out of the blue trying to convince people of something that I think is cool, but rather my knowledge of the space, the competitive understanding, the goals of the business. So I really do a lot of work upfront from the brand perspective in terms of understanding that and demonstrating that understanding. So benchmarking is a great way to sort of take yourself out of that fight. If you show the client examples of what are considered best in class, and you highlight why those matter, and you make those connections in terms of what you want to do, people are not going to argue. They're not going to argue with airlines that have done a great job at that. So Southwest, I think, has done a great job of evolving their brand. They have a very specific mandate. But if I were to bring a benchmark into the discussion and explain why, I think people are more up to be like, okay, that makes sense. That's logical. But if I get into this, like, oh, I'm just going to sort of overwhelm them with my creative passion, that doesn't really work. So it's my job to demonstrate an understanding, to build that path. And then the mock-ups have to look amazing. That's another trick, is that my job is to create something so impactful in that first moment that they see it, that they see themselves in it. Like, they marry to it very quickly. And so I took a lot of care with the mock-ups. I worked with a renderer who created very lifelike, realistic mock-ups, as opposed to just doing the mock-up on a flat, line art. I did something much more sort of realistic. And so I think that helped them sort of, no vision, no decision, and they could see themselves in this.
How many iterations did you have to go through to get to that point?
Hundreds, like internal, like so many rounds back and forth tweaking. And that's the obsessive nature of the business. And it's one that I sort of like it, actually. My favorite part of the job is when I can bring my team into a studio and they'll have put up on the wall, 50 different tears, and we'll do a crit. So we'll go through and we'll ask very specific questions and we'll debate it and we'll fight over something. And we'll, that exhaustive phase of articulating a thought, debating that idea, editing, and we keep doing that. And I think the clients, they don't really see it, but there's so much work that goes on behind the scenes to get to something that sort of looks like, oh, that looks great. Like, I like it or I don't like it. But the work and the obsessive nature of the, the creative design editing process is, it's an exceptional part of the business. So I like that. And I think people who work with creatives enjoy having that time to analyze together. I mean, it's actually rare. Most projects are done where everyone is siloed, the timelines are tight, everyone is expected to come up with their little piece. But when I can bring people around a table and say, okay, what are we doing here? What do we think? I think it brings out the best in creative people. They like to be able to articulate their thoughts. So it's part of it.
You mentioned your team. How big is your team that you get into one room to kind of debate these issues?
It's small. I mean, I've worked with bigger teams, but right now I work with a small team, and they're not, they're not seasoned. They're more junior, but their attitudes are excellent. So I'm a big fan of finding people who are open, who are resourceful, who have talent. And then, I lead that process, of course, and I use my experience to help get a win-win happening. So, Claire was involved, not literally in the creative, but I definitely was asking her thoughts. A designer that I work with, Alfredo, he was involved as well. And it's intensive. And I expect, until we hit the solution, that people are going to just, it's kind of a little bit the cliche where you're like, you live and breathe that project. So it's not 9 to 5. On the weekends, I'm constantly thinking about things. I'm getting people in if I can. And because I only have so much time. The client will only wait so long. And then you've got one kick at the can. So once you present, if you don't get it right, it's hard because you then the client starts to make their own decisions. Then they're trying to fix it for you and you can lose control. So I think the more you can hit it on the nose the first time, the higher the likelihood that design will see its way through. But that's a hope. I can't guarantee that. And I've definitely had situations where clients have made changes and you've had to sort of rethink things. And that is part of the business. I have thick skin. I can do it. But this project was exceptional in that the client was relatively on board from day one. There was not a lot of changes that happened.
What's the timeline from when you said, okay, we're going to do this, until you presented them with something that they said, ah, wow, that's incredible?
It was,
which I'm sure they said.
Yeah. I'm trying to think now. So this whole project has taken a year. Rob came to us around a year ago, last spring. There was probably a month of research, maybe a month and a half, and planning, and at the same time, beginning to sort of do some design. We presented the brand and livery around the same time. It all happened the first stage happened pretty fast. And then from there, once they saw the vision, then that all sort of was put to the side. And we began working on other initiatives, such as a microsite, PR, sort of other aspects of the project. But probably about 2 months all in was the timeline for getting the go ahead to do the work, to showing the brand. And it was a big presentation deck. It was like a 150-page deck that talked about, you know, the market, the customer, the design, the inspiration, where it could go in the future, what the interior of the aircraft could look like. So it was merely my job to bring it all to life in mock form. And then as those projects became sort of, you know, real, certain aspects of that presentation were then used as inspiration to guide. So the interior of the aircraft is not something that I worked on, but sort of my vision for what the interior should be was sort of my job. And then a separate firm worked on building out, you know, picking materials, selecting the proper seats and doing all of that, which I think, Brian, you may have seen at the at the reveal. So,
yeah, there's a nice mock-up of the seats and the different classes and some photographs showing what it looks like inside the airplane itself.
Yeah. Again, we're phase one here. There's plenty more to do, but, you know, definitely the plane is now a reality and the market has seen it. And so, let's cross my fingers that it's as well received as it was on the night that we did the reveal.
Tell us a little bit more about the mock-ups. Are these 3D models and how were they made and how big are they? Are these the kinds of things we'd see in an executive's office? And at some point, are they similar to the kinds of things that you were flying around the fields as a kid growing up?
So the mock-up for the livery went into a CAD format fairly soon. So I probably started with just the initial, like, well, what do I want to do? And that was pencils and me printing out a simple line art that I got off the internet of 757-200 series. And then a lot of back and forth on just directions. And then once I settled on something that was like, okay, I'm kind of in the zone, then I called up my trusted renderer. He's in South America. He's in Argentina, actually. And he's an aviation enthusiast himself. So we hit it off and I said, okay, well, here's kind of what I'm thinking. And so I gave him the aircraft type. He researched that. And then he went to town and he built out the aircraft as a CAD so that he can flip it and turn it and he can access it in any way. And then he married my initial sort of drawings and designs onto the plane. And then we went back and forth on making, you know, adjustments. And then it finally made its way to the client.
And does it ever become a 3D model that you can physically hold?
For the reveal ceremony, we actually had a model. We had a VIP dinner the night before for 20 of selected individuals. And we had a model on the center of the table, I think a 26-inch model, which was on a stand. And we're going to get more made. So now that everything is sort of carved in stone, it's going to then be made into various models for certain people to have or promotion, whatnot. So, yeah.
Yeah, and sadly, I wasn't invited to that dinner.
Yeah, well, I didn't even realize that that was going to happen. The model was going to the dinner I knew about, but the model was a surprise to us. It was actually a gift by one of the vendors who just before the dinner was to happen, he unveiled it, or he took it out of the box.
Having participated in the event, I had two questions over the livery design itself. Because when I first saw the aircraft, there's the Northern Pacific wording, and then you have a very large N that's stylized. When I very first saw it, I thought it was dirt on the plane. It looked like a smudge. So I don't mean to be insulting over this, but it's curious to me as to how that design came about. And certainly after I looked at it from a few different angles, like you were talking before, I actually grew to like it. But my very first impression was it was a smudge. So was that ever part of the design conversation, and did other people see it that way?
We want a smudge.
No, it's just, you know, did it look like a smudge as opposed to this is an intentional stylistic N that I didn't see at first, but I grew to really like.
Yeah, well, it's very subtle. I couldn't see it. I'm looking at the picture going, what's Brian talking about? It's like, oh, there it
there's
is.
There's a smudge.
I mean, No. It's very light. It's not as prominent as the word itself.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think everybody has an impression, and that's, I think, actually part of the beauty of this whole business is that you are able to have your own impressions. And so I'm fine with that. I think the intention was always to do something where I wanted to mitigate I didn't want to just have a white plane. And if I'm going to use black as an accent, I wanted something to sort of offset that harsh contrast. And I also wanted to give the namesake or the letter form of Northern Pacific some type of dimension or depth. So I early on was thinking about something graphic that would act as sort of a subtle bed behind the logo type. It was always sort of an early sort of design sort of thought direction. I've also seen how airlines today often will take the logo and blast it large on the side of the aircraft. And I didn't want to go down that path. Cause it's common, and it's often driven by commerce. It's clients who say, I want people to see and read that aircraft from a distance. And so they make the lettering huge. Mm-hmm. But in the spirit of having something very large on the side of the aircraft that related to the letter form, I decided to sort of turn the dial in a different direction and go with something that was, in my opinion, very modern and soft, ethereal. It had movement. It gave a sense of elegance, and yet still sort of came a little bit from that inspiration of large lettering on the side of the aircraft. So that was part of it. And there are other airlines that have done similar designs and have used the side of the aircraft in that capacity. So I had, you know, there was some benchmarks to say that is something that is done, but it definitely is a distinctive mark that may not necessarily be as conventional as other design approaches. So, but I haven't heard any complaints about it or questions, so we'll see. But
yeah, okay.
Wait till it gets on the blogs, and we're going to see. People will have their thoughts.
Oh, so they always do.
The other thing that absolutely stood out in this is you did the black outline of the windows in the flight deck.
Yes.
And that is a theme or a design consideration that Airbus used on the A350. Mm-hmm. So did you know that, and is that an intention on your part to make it look like the A350, or is it just a design and it turned out that way?
It was very intentional. Here was my theory how do I take a 757 that is, you know, rather dated now? It's an older aircraft type. It doesn't have necessarily some of the sexier features that are with Boeing's newer models or even Airbus. I always knew I wanted to do something with the windshield in terms of masking. And I had proposed many other design directions for the front, and that was the one that the client gravitated towards, and I was happy with it. But other airlines have done the same thing. I think Air Canada is doing something similar as well with their newer aircraft, using sort of the same kind of masking approach. But I definitely knew that A350 had it, and I liked it. And I thought, well, I'm going to add something to this aircraft type And some people like it. Others are like, well, hold on, is that the A350? But I think it works really nicely with the design. And I did have, actually, Brian, a pilot came up to me that night of the reveal. And he said to me, first of all, I think you did a great job, but I want you to know I'm the guy that flew that actual plane. And he said to me, I want to thank you for giving that aircraft new life. And what you did for that aircraft for me is you made it special again, because I flew it way back at many years ago. So I appreciated that comment, because it had a semblance of, it wasn't just this arbitrary, oh, I like it. It was sort of a connection he was making between old and new. And so he read that design in a very sort of specific way. And I, of course, appreciate that. But it was intentional and something that I wanted to have that aircraft own from a design point of view. So
I wondered, what I think of aircraft liveries, there are some that jump out at me more than others. And I know one that was way back in the 70s that you probably don't even remember because you were still walking around in the fields at that time. But I don't know if you ever saw any of Alexander Calder's work with Braniff and what you thought of that, good or bad.
There's been so much written about Braniff. For a good reason. I mean, that airline was sort of a statement of all that is possible when you bring the best creative people, the most forward-thinking business people. Is it Mary Wells? Is that her name? The woman who was the CEO of the ad agency that led the charge to bring on people like Alexander Girard, who actually did the livery for the Braniff aircraft. And then Caldwell was commissioned to do these special editions. The campaign that they titled The End of the Plane, just genius. And I wish we had more of that spirit today, which, you know, and so much of what has happened in the past is very much my inspiration for what I'm trying to do. I'm less interested in what's going on today with modern airlines, although there's plenty to talk about. I'm very much driven by the innovation, the passion, the point of view, around livery design specifically, that you see from the past, whether it was, you know, United Airlines, Continental, you know, Saul Bass and his work, Pan American's work with Charles Forberg. I mean, there are so many amazing designers and creative people involved in airlines that are now defunct, but they live on, I think, in the memory of many people. So, yeah.
I'm sorry, I just need to jump in because I fly an awful lot on United, and I have no idea how their battleship gray livery ever got approved, because that was the most depressing livery ever to fly on. Oh my God, I hated those 5-7 years that thing existed. And as soon as that could be retired, I was so incredibly happy.
Yeah.
Because don't.
Did you like the tulip design? Did you like.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I was very, very sad to see the Continental Globe take over instead of the tulip.
Like, I don't understand. I mean, I know why they did it, but why would the aircraft share two, like the Continental and the United? It just felt like sort of market confusion, in my opinion, and it spoke to all the wrong sort of reasons why you do it. I don't know, but.
Yeah. They blew it on that.
I don't get
keeping
it.
The people from Continental happy.
Yes.
There were a lot of people that did not want to see United purchase or merge with Continental. And I often thought that was a great compromise for them.
Yeah, but it made sense on paper. Let me put it that way. I just, as an airplane enthusiast, I didn't really, you know, I didn't like the final product, but I understood why. And, you know, it speaks to a whole other issue, which is just the consolidation of the market and sort of how difficult it is to make, you know, make these airlines work. But how about Northwest Orient? Like the beautiful livery that they had commissioned that got watered down by Landor in the 90s. But prior to that, they had this gorgeous red tail with the white, the gray, the blue, the striping. It was very
so
modern.
Distinctive.
Very gorgeous. So, you know, interesting though.
Continental had that, wasn't it Continental that had that golden tail
the
at one
stream.
Time?
Yeah.
as they used to call it in here in Chicago, they took it down a notch and called it the airplane with a brass ass. But, you know, we're a little common sometimes here in Chicago. So, you know, but
I'm making a note of that one. I'm going to use that one.
Okay. Yeah. So maybe there might be a brass ass airlines. Anyway,
I mean, yeah.
Is there a place where all these old logos go to die? I mean, is there a museum of aircraft logos, liveries?
Oh, there must be. I mean, that's the beauty of the internet. I mean, you can find all kinds of amazing sort of heritage sites. And I mean, Braniff has a whole foundation that you can be a member of, and they put on these amazing events. And there's such a rich visual history of the Braniff brand. So, you know, yeah, I wish we could see more of it, to be honest.
Edmund, is there a livery for a current day airline that kind of strikes your fancy, sort of stands out as one that impresses you?
Yeah, I mean, it's first of all, it's that spectrum of different solutions. I mean, so I have to think about this. So I like what and Brian, we might lock horns on this one. I'm not sure. You tell me. But I actually really appreciate what Lufthansa has done in terms of moving that brand and that livery forward with a scalpel and doing things, you know, where they took the blue and they just gave it more punch. They got rid of the yellow, which some people are not happy about, although that yellow does find itself used in other applications, but as an accent. And it's not trying to be more than it is. And that's the German aesthetic, which I appreciate. I think Qantas has done a good job. Mark Newson's work for the brand has been exceptional. I think Air France has really shown us how you can take heritage and modernize it in a charming, modern way. So I really like what they've created. Gulf Air, I think, has a very striking livery, which is a very different tone and feel. It's much more glamour and much more drama and sort of. So I really like what they've done. The Falcon motif has been sort of used. I think Air Canada has done a good job in terms of where they've come from. I really had a problem with the tube of toothpaste design, which was the turquoise plane. But they've gone back. I mean, they're a national airline. And I never understood. Well, I would have a problem with, if you're a national airline, you need to show something that has esteem, not necessarily trendy. And so what they've done today, I think, is way better for the overall. I mean, again, everyone has their own opinion, but I think they've done a great job. I think SAS has done a great job of their livery. I'm not sure if you've seen what they've done. It's quite beautiful. And the paint job, I would love to talk to the people who were involved in the application of that livery onto the aircraft, because it's using all types of interesting matte paint grades and sort of glossy. I don't know how they achieved that, but pretty impressive. So.
Yeah. Is that one of the considerations, how easy it is to put the livery on the aircraft?
Well, keep in mind, the factories are driven in a very different way. So these are not artists, although I will say there's a lot of artistic, amazing people who work within those facilities. But their job is to get it done, and they're following a different set of criteria. So they're looking at blueprints. They're working with, you know, physical elements, the paints. And so it's a very different world. What I now realize and what I'm learning is, be careful what you propose, because it's so easy on a computer to be like, oh, yeah, let's do a full gradient. Let's make the whole plane a gradient. I mean, again, SAS did, prior to their newest livery, a design that had the whole fuselage sort of gradate. How do you reproduce that? Mm-hmm. First of all, you have to lay it down properly. How do they accurately reproduce that against 50 aircraft? I don't know, times all the various models. So I think it's important to understand the production techniques so that you're putting the client in a win-win when they are wanting a plane that is going to be easy to reproduce accurately. So I think definitely something that I have learned more about. Yeah, but the paint is a big one. I went to South Carolina, actually, to personally oversee the selection and making of the two different grays that make up, as Brian puts it, the smudge. See, now that's going to stick with me.
Sorry about that.
No, I love it. I actually love it. And I totally... But those two grays had to be just soft enough so that you didn't have a very contrasty overlap. So picking those colors was a very important part. And So yeah, I went down there and sat in the factory and worked with the team there.
And then all of the liveries, they're painted. They're not decals, correct?
Well, some can be made.
Or can you do decals?
Yeah, you can. Like, well, I'm not sure if I'm using the right terminology, but you can spray it with a masking, which I think is a sort of the plane is done as a the primary colors. It's like painting anything else. It's given a primer, and then eventually they, after those base coats are applied, then they lay down the colors. Colors react differently when they're laid down on whites. Gradients can be sprayed manually, but you can also produce a dot matrix that is like a, you know, like a dot pattern that is put onto the aircraft and then peeled off. And those tiny dots upon inspection, right, when you look further away, it just reads as a soft gradient. I think British Airways is using that. Well, many airlines, I'm sure, do that. But I noticed that British Airways has that for their flag. And I think it ensures that the reproduction is accurate. So that's a big part of why they do it.
Paint can be a factor as well. Right? Paint weighs something. Yeah. And, you know, if you paint an entire airplane nose to tail, there's a lot of weight there. I don't know if that comes into the design consideration.
I think it's partially why they don't paint certain parts of the plane. I don't think the wing is a candidate for any paint. And it probably has to do with weight and balance. So, yeah, there's definitely a lot of considerations to where paint goes in terms of lift and aerodynamic.
And so I've heard with American Airlines, when they had the aluminum color, it was not painted at all. And I've heard that part of that reason was because of weight and fuel savings. Yeah. Don't know if it's true or not, but that's what urban legend is.
I've been asking about that myself because I really like the livery with the striping, sort of classic, you know. But I and I think other airlines may have. Didn't Eastern also have at one point the shiny steel aircraft, which, you know, just again plays into the romance of these incredible machines that are flying people, and I think that was kind of cool. But yeah.
Well, Edmund, it sounds like, or it seems like you are in a line of work that doesn't have a huge number of client opportunities, or am I wrong? I'm thinking, how often do new liveries get created, and how often do airlines revise or change their liveries? It seems like it's chasing this a little bit of work.
For sure. This line of work is not one where – you know, the projects come to you a lot. I mean, a lot of these projects are referral-based, first of all. And so the more experience you have in the field, the more people who know of what you do, and I think people talk, and that's sort of where a lot of our business comes from. We're not necessarily going to probably be hired by the major airlines. Those airlines are working within a multinational ad agency network, and those networks have approved vendors, and, you know, so that's probably not my reality. My world would be with small, medium-sized airlines, startups. That would be where I would probably be most apt to do work. So we're being approached by people who are starting companies or who are changing the company. Sometimes it's a small regional carrier that needs to upgrade the brand. Delivery becomes part of that discussion. So yeah, I'm kind of in that zone, I think, small, medium.
But that's got to be more satisfying. Don't you feel like you have more of an impact with these companies? If you were doing one of the majors, you'd be one tiny voice out of literally, you know, 1,000 different inputs on the design.
Yeah, you're absolutely. I mean, even the people that work with me, I think they've had such visibility and access to these projects, unprecedented, because if you're a junior or even a more senior person, there's so many more layers to that project. The decision-making is probably highly protracted. In my world, I'm working with the founder, the CEO, a small board of directors, and that's not necessarily an easy thing. If you're the founder of an airline, you are most likely an operator. You probably were a pilot or you're very hands-on. And a lot of the smaller airlines, they don't necessarily they're not as comfortable making decisions in marketing as they are in terms of purchasing an aircraft or fuel or hedging. You know, things that they're comfortable spending money on are things that have to do with the operation. When you bring a branding person into the mix, sometimes they're not necessarily sort of familiar or necessarily wanting to spend. And so you have to compel them. You have to earn their trust. And you also have to deal with the ego of that individual who has their own vision. So even though you're very close to the project, I have a whole other set of challenges. And I think it helps to be passionate about aviation. And people who start airlines are usually airplane geeks themselves. Most of the people I know who are working in that capacity have a love for the business. And why wouldn't they? It's a tough business to be in. It's a real high risky business. So a lot of their interest is in part, like, they just love planes. And so when they can talk to somebody as a designer who's like, I love planes too, I don't know, that's a bit of common ground that I think is a good starting point. So yeah, I generally would agree with you though, Max. I think it's probably a better situation for me to be working in that way versus, you know, lost in a sea of consultants working on like a mainline carrier or something. So,
yeah, I think you're fortunate, Edmund, in that, you know, you are able to combine both a passion for aviation and a passion for the design and the, you know, and the art and all. Not everyone gets that opportunity to combine those kinds of passions.
Yeah, I'm grateful. Very grateful. Yeah, we'll see what happens. I mean, there's plenty more to do. And I, as I may have mentioned, our practice area is expanding in the aviation space. So, and we're interested in other aspects of that category. So not just liveries, but the marketing, targeting of consumers through digital media. I'm even interested in the interiors side of it, even though I'm not part of an architectural firm. I've always been interested in wayfinding. And some of those disciplines sort of ebb and flow next to me. So with Northern Pacific, Rob McKinney was like, hey, I want to show you the new terminal, or not new terminal, but this terminal that we have access to with 8 exclusive gates that are going to facilitate access to the flights. And so naturally then he says to me, well, you know, what are your thoughts for the terminal? And what would you do in terms of the brand? So sometimes I'm touching other aspects of the projects that are not necessarily like pure graphic design. And I like that stuff too. I've always been very interested in wayfinding, actually. It's sort of another sort of specialty skill set.
And Edmund, we've talked about really corporate liveries, but there's an awful lot of, I think, innovative, very nice looking corporate jets that are being painted beyond just the normal, dull, boring, non aesthetically pleasing, white.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts towards that?
So when I was in San Bernardino to see the plane for the first time, I went into the hangar and there was a G8 being painted, a Gulfstream that was being painted. And it was speaking of gradients, the nose of the plane was white. And then it progressively, very smoothly went to black. It's like a soft, it was like a ghosted sort of like black that in the back of the aircraft was black. Super beautiful. And that I'm sure is being driven very much by the owner. I did a project for Island Air, and it was one that was concerning Larry Ellison of Oracle. So he bought the island of Lanai and he wanted to buy an airline. And so we were hired to help upgrade this sleepy island commuter into something that would catch his eye and be seen as worthy. And so my point is, Larry Ellison, who I had the pleasure of speaking to on occasion, incredibly interested in art and design and in very, very hands-on. And a lot of these sort of high net worth individuals look at those aircraft as badges for them, you know, personal badges. So to your point, Brian, I think it lends itself to, you get to see some really extraordinary work. Some of it is a bit garish and probably a little heavy-handed. But a lot of it is quite beautiful as well. And some of it is just kind of corporate and generic. Like I've seen some that are just like, okay, well, white plane with a gray stripe, you know, all right. Mm-hmm. But the aircraft I saw in San Bernardino was like so beautiful. And I didn't get to go inside. Peter Clark, my business partner, snuck on. They were giving tours or they were talking about it. And he went in, he said it was quite beautiful. So that's another whole world I'd love to be involved in, is designing the interior, because I'm a big fan of the interior side as well. And materiality and amenities and overall layout and use of space. I'm very interested in that.
Yeah. And a few years ago, Max East and I got got to go on a tour at the Boeing factory, and we got to see the fabric samples that they had and the different galleys and lavs and just the choices that the airlines have. It was, I found it fascinating.
Oh, me too. I mean, I'm very interested in I like to see what airlines are doing for their cabins. I think Finnair is doing a beautiful job of their new interiors, which I was just looking at today, both in terms of color palette, but also ergonomic, industrial design, how to turn these, especially in the first class or business class cabins. You see it, some exceptional use of technology and built form where these little suites are like these little sort of like they're just filled with technology. They're like living, breathing entities, but they've got that plush sort of element. I love all that stuff. And it feeds into my fascination with, you know, the glamour of airport and the movie and how people traveled. I was always sort of drawn to that.
Yeah. How could you not be?
Right. Absolutely. I know.
So Edmund, thank you so much for spending some time with us and also for powering through some technical issues at the beginning.
Thank you. I appreciate your patience. And I promise to get better headsets for my next one.
For next time.
Yeah.
Edmund, where can our listeners go to learn more about your work, the company, any other resources you might think about?
So our firm is Forward Media. The design division is forward-studio.co. And that's where some of the work is. You can see it. But I would say if you're interested in livery design and all things airline, I always check out Under Consideration /Brand New. They do excellent sort of profiles of before and afters with a whole like spectrum of, you know, whether it's corporate technology, but they do a lot of airline review. And so I often check out Under Consideration /Brand New is a really good resource. There's a million great blogs out there as well and resources in that capacity. But that's probably what I would suggest.
All right, good. And we'll have those links in the show notes, of course. So if you're listening to this in the car or something, you can go to the show notes and find those links. So again, Edmund, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Hey, thanks for joining us.
All right, guys. Take it easy.
Okay. I'll mention that Rob McKinney, CEO of Northern Pacific Airways, released a video on YouTube of their livery reveal event that was held in San Bernardino. Look for that in the show notes. Also, Brian Coleman spoke with Robert Kinney after the reveal. You can find that conversation in episode 688 at airplanegeeks.com/688. Let me take the opportunity to explain something that can make it easier for you to go back and listen to a certain segment of this show without having to fast forward until you find it. And that's podcast chapters. Some podcast apps support chapters, and some podcasts produce episodes with chapter markers embedded, like we do. If both these conditions are met, you just go to the chapter list in the app, tap the chapter you are after, and it starts playing from there. Pretty handy, eh? Pocket Casts supports chapters. Also, the Apple Podcast app, Overcast, Podcast Addict, and some others. If yours doesn't, maybe it's time to look around. I'm a big Pocket Casts fan. Really powerful podcast management functionality for power listeners. It's free. Check it out. Not a sponsor. Next, our good friends at the Plain Talking UK podcast recently celebrated a major milestone, their 400th episode. To celebrate the occasion, PTUK recorded the episode with an audience, and in that audience was our main man Micah and Brian Coleman. That's right, they flew across the pond to join in the festivities. Well, Micah narrated a presentation that captures the power of the aviation podcasting community, and we've got the audio for you here. Or if you prefer, you can find the video in the show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/694 or at the Airplane Geeks YouTube channel. It's a very meager channel. We have some work to do there. All right, here we go.
Here I am in Great Britain, having traveled all the way from the east coast of the USA to celebrate the 400th episode of Plain Talking UK. It's kind of funny how I think about the PTUK podcast. You see, I'm very proud of them, like the pride I would feel for a younger brother. You got to understand that sometimes, most times in fact, I think about a whole bunch of podcasts as family. There's the airplane geeks, the oldest sibling, then the airline pilot guy, the middle child, and our younger brother, Plain Talking UK. Now, there are other parts of the family, too. For example, there's the Plane Safety Podcast, the adopted sibling that someone left on our doorstep one day. We took them in because, well, it's a mitzvah, the right thing to do, and, of course, there's always room at our table. Then there are some of those odd podcast cousins. Flying in Life is one of them. So is the A320 Podcast, and, of course, Opposing Bases. We have some drunken uncles, too, though I promise not to talk about them here. But we're a big, happy family, too big, in fact, for all of us to gather together in one place, so not everyone could be here in person to celebrate PTUK's big day. The fact is, I wasn't sure I was going to attend this celebration in person either. Do you know why I'm here? Well, you can blame Brian Coleman for it. Yes, Pasadena Brian Coleman, former associate producer of the Airplane Geeks podcast and creator and host of the Journey is the Reward podcast, you can blame him. I certainly do. It's his fault. He's the reason I'm here. It all started almost exactly 6 years ago. It was February of 2016 when Brian called me and asked if I wanted to go to the Farnborough Air Show. I was reluctant. Why would I want to travel all that way for another air show? I didn't know Brian that well back then. Neither of us can remember exactly when we actually met in person. It was sometime before that phone call when we recorded a show as part of the Airplane Geeks at the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, Udvar-Hazy Center. It took me a couple of years to find out that Brian can sell ice to Eskimos. Needless to say, within 2 weeks of that February 2016 phone call, the trip to Farnborough was planned. I've regretted it ever since. It was during that trip that I got to meet Nev, an impeccable host, I might add, and Carlos and Matt and Owen and Pip and Al and on and on and on. You know, all the usual suspects. It was just awful. I found out I really liked them. And then they seemed to like me, too, or at least tolerated me enough to be able to humor me into believing that they liked me. It was during that trip that I first appeared on PTUK. It was a live show from Farnborough on the deck of the airshow press area. In order to get that space, Carlos and I had to do some fancy talking and ended up appearing together on the Farnborough Airshow radio network. All of us became friends, stayed pretty well in touch, close enough that many of us got together the following year in Pittsburgh thanks to Major Rick Bell. That, by the way, is when Matt learned of Brian's great sales abilities. Matt found himself in the middle of the Atlantic on a United 757, wondering how he got into that predicament. Like I said, you can blame Brian. Since then, Brian and I got into a rhythm of travel planning together. For the most part, he handles the air and I handle the ground. We did it for Pittsburgh and several more trips to the Smithsonian, and well, here I am. Yes, he did it again. Sure, they say forewarned is forearmed, but it doesn't often work that way. It was early April of last year when the phone rang again, and it was Brian. Hey, Micah, he said, I hear PTUK 400 is coming up in February 2022. I knew it was coming. I knew I would be helpless to his Svengali-like sales technique. I've been looking at flights, he said. You know, I hate to fly across the pond from the East Coast. Not enough flight time to get any sleep, but I can arrange flights so we can meet in Chicago and cross the pond together. I didn't even fight it this time. I knew it would be a losing battle. I just said, I'll start working on the hotels. The hotel situation wasn't too difficult. Other than some complications for our last night in the UK, Radisson split its reward program in two, one for the USA and one for the rest of the world. That took a couple of months to get straightened out so I could use my points here in the UK. Eventually, I was able to get us rooms at the Radisson Blue at Heathrow, a hotel I'd been wanting to try for quite a while. Then a few weeks ago, I got an email from Radisson saying that they raised the yellow flag over the Radisson Blue. It's a COVID quarantine hotel now. They moved us to the Radisson Red, a lesser value for the same amount of points, but okay. As it turned out, that was the least of our travel problems. You see, United changed my flight reservations no less than six times. Originally, I was to leave Portland, Maine at 2 p.m. local, get into Chicago 2 hours later, then board our flight to LHR at about 9 p.m. local. Not so bad. Brian was getting in from LAX around 4, and we'd hang out in the Polaris Lounge together. Well, things changed over and over and over until I was leaving PWM at 7 a.m. and stuck at ORD until 9 p.m. and getting into LHR at 11 a.m. I would be traveling for 24 hours straight, all for what should be about 10 hours of travel time when leaving from Portland. I figured I was stuck, but Brian said, "Leave it to me." I don't know how he did it, but with all his persistence, maybe perseveration, and certainly sales technique, Brian found someone at United Reservations with godlike powers. One day I was eating dinner. A text came in. "I'm on the phone with United. They want to patch you in. Can we call you now?" That was a no-brainer. The phone rang a few minutes later. So we started talking to this reservation agent, and it turns out he's an airplane geek, in lowercase letters. Well, you know me and Brian, we can't talk to anyone without chatting them up. We learn he's been handling reservations since the days of Continental Airlines. He stayed on when they merged with United and became one of their top agents. He even creates and conducts training classes for other reservation agents. He tells us that flights to Chicago from Portland are limited, but asks, how can he help? What would make it easy for us? Now remember, Brian doesn't like to fly across the pond from the east coast of the USA. It's just too short a flight for him to be able to settle down and sleep. So I said, okay, what if I flew to L.A.? Then Brian could meet me there, and we can go nonstop LAX to LHR together. The agent didn't blink an eye and said, okay, and started looking for flights. He came back and told us that United no longer offered direct flights to London from L.A., but they do from San Francisco. Brian asked if it could be arranged for us to meet at SFO, and the agent said, sure. I told you Brian was a silver-tongued devil, didn't I? I figured, what the heck? Rather than sitting in an airport for 12 hours, I might as well be flying. With the air circulation, mask mandates, and privacy of business class, I'd be safer from COVID in the air than at an airport. Plus, what a story! So I agreed to crisscross the USA in order to eventually cross the Atlantic all in one day. So like I said, blame it all on Brian. Well, and a bit on PTUK and the rest of my friends here who I so desperately wanted to see. And of course, I have to take a bit of responsibility myself for being an airplane geek in both upper and lowercase letters. And that's the story of how Uncle Micah, your main man from Portland, Maine, on the northeast coast of the USA, flew to San Francisco to get here to Weybridge in the UK to celebrate 400 wonderful episodes of Plain Talking UK. Damn, I wonder what's going to happen for the 500th.
I'm happy to say that David's exhibit, The Helicopter and the Presidency, was unveiled at the American Helicopter Museum and Education Center on March 4th, 2022. I drove down from Connecticut and attended the members-only sneak preview of the exhibit. As you'd expect from David, the exhibit provides a fascinating look into the history and roles the helicopter played in the American presidency. It started with President Eisenhower, but did you know he was blasted in the press for it? They painted a picture of Ike spending taxpayer dollars to fund his trips to the country club. Of course, that was inaccurate, but they eventually got it right. The exhibit preview included presentations via Zoom with Roger Connor, curator of the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum Aeronautics Department. We've had him on the show before. And also U.S. Marine Corps Colonel Ray Frenchy Leroy, a former Marine One pilot and author of Inside Marine One, Four U.S. Presidents, One Proud Marine, and the World's Most Amazing Helicopter. Both of them gave us really impressive historical insights. It was a really, really good session. The museum is located outside Westchester, Pennsylvania, on the north side of Brandywine Regional Airport, KOQN, with its own helipad, ramp, and runway access. So you can fly in or drive in, as you choose. Remember that the American Helicopter Museum is offering Airplane Geeks listeners a one-year individual membership at a 50% discount. That's $25, normally $50, and you get unlimited admission to the museum for 1 year, 2 one-day guest passes, admission to Family Fest and Santa Fest, invitations to member receptions, and a 10% discount on gift shop purchases. This offer is good through May 31st, 2022, at the link in the show notes for this episode. So please consider supporting the American Helicopter Museum. I did, and I'm told a number of you did as well. So thank you. And thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Our guest this episode was Edmund Hewitt, Chief Creative Officer and partner at Forward Media, as well as its design division, Forward Studio. You can find that at forward-studio.co. And, of course, you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. The direct link for the show notes for this episode is airplanegeeks.com/694. And there you'll find the Northern Pacific Airways livery reveal video, the video version of Micah's presentation at the Plane Talking UK 400th episode, and the link for the membership discount at the American Helicopter Museum. You can reach us via email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And if you like the Airplane Geeks podcast, be sure to subscribe in your podcast app so you don't miss any episodes. If you go old school, you can get an email notice when each episode publishes. Just go to subscribebyemail.com and type in Airplane Geeks. That's it. You'll get an email with an embedded player with each episode. And here's the secret. Subscribebyemail.com. It works with any podcast. So please join us next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.